I'm here today to talk to you a little bit about the challenges of testing security software. And you heard from the introduction what my background in this area is. So the overview, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the AMTSO, Anti-Malware Testing Standards Organization, then a little bit about the basics of testing, the different types of testings that are done, and then an area which was of particular interest, which is sample selection, which is one of the larger challenges. The AMTSO was formed in 2008 in Bilbao. It actually had its initial formation in a bar in Reykjavik, Iceland, where a group of us got together and said, testing's bad, we need to fix it. It's a coalition of testers and vendors and academia. I didn't include them, sorry. Sorry, Jose. Our charter is to provide a forum for discussing discussions related to testing of anti-malware software, developing and publicizing objective standards and best practices, promoting education and awareness, and providing tools and resources. So a little bit of testing basics.
Sense, how big is the organization?
There are about 30 members, primarily security vendors, but there are more security vendors than there are testers.
But are like all the security vendor heavyweights part, or some?
Most.
And are those results published?
The results.
Yes.
Oh.
So we tested, we can look and say, well, this particular vendor is not really doing very good, so.
AMTSO doesn't test security software. We come up with standards and guidelines for how security software should be tested.
Okay. Thank you.
So the testing basics, you have your how many malicious samples are detected, that's your detection rate. How many innocent samples are detected, that's your false positive rate. And there's different ways of measuring false positives. When we're developing internal heuristics, there's three classifications we have of false positives. There's your per file false positive rate, so I tested 10,000 files and five of them were bad, so that's my FP rate. There is your alert accuracy false positive rate, which is of the number of detections that actually popped up on somebody's screen. How many of those were correct? And that's gonna be a lower number. And then the last one is your user experience false positive rate, which is of all the people in the world that are running your software, how many of them would have seen that false positive? That's actually the one internally at Symantec that we target. How many customers do we affect, not how many files did we detect on? So the difference between having a false positive on Excel and having a false positive on somebody's homegrown utility that he and three of his friends have.
Are you particularly file-focused, or do you also think about in-memory testing, you know, malware detection, et cetera?
It's machine, really, is where the way we look at it. How many machines, how many of our customers' machines experienced false positives?
And maybe you're going to go into it, but do you address issues of labeling? Like, does it label it correctly, or is it just, does it detect, yes, the bad things there?
More the latter. Most of the security companies, because of the volumes and things of malware that came up, got away from doing labeling at all. We just kind of call everything generic. He's bad, you don't want it.
Right.
For most consumer-type customers, home users, that's sufficient for them. They don't really care what it was. Corporations, on the other hand, care very much what it was. So there's actually a trend moving back to try to get more specific, if we can, about what we're labeling things as.
Us researchers care too, because often it's going to how do we assess this corpus of stuff we get? How do we know which ones are the same?
Right. Repair efficacy, how well are you able to clean up a machine once it's been infected? And then performance, what impact does running the security software on a machine have? There's different types of testing. Static testing, that started back in the 80s. That is, I have N number of malicious samples, and I'm going to take somebody's command line scanner, and I'm going to scan them all, and I'm going to see how many they detect. Then in the early 2000s, this retrospective testing came into vogue, which was, I'm going to freeze a set of definitions, on a given day, and then I'm going to collect malware samples after that day, and I'm going to see how many of those are detected with the old definitions. So it was a way of trying to measure the proactive capability of a product to detect a previously unknown threat. Dynamic testing came around in 2007. That was where we were actually actively infecting machines on a live internet with a full product running to see whether or not they were detected. This is because in this time frame, in the mid-2000s and to now, security products added many additional layers of protection. IPS went in, we have behavior blocking, we have reputation-based blocking, all of these things which are not exercised by just using the static scanner. So if you were only measuring how effective the static scanner was, you were not getting an accurate representation of how effective the product was against a given threat. And then dynamic moved into real-world testing. So let's learn about this evolution of the protection technology by taking a view of a completely different industry. Back in the 50s and the 60s, car safety was basically your seatbelt. So if you measured how effective seatbelts were, you would get some measure of how safe a given car was. But modern cars added a whole bunch of layers on top of that. They added active braking, meaning that some cars can actually sense that there's a vehicle in front of you and apply the brakes even if you don't. There's anti-lock brakes. There's airbags. There's crumple zones. So car safety tests had to evolve to the point where they were actually crashing vehicles or attempting to crash vehicles to see how safe they were. That became real-world tests.
The story of the safest accident. It's not the crumple zones to absorb the impact. And it's not the airbags when the ice turns to black. You see, the safest accident is the one that never happens. The 2008 RX offering 14 actively safe features. Learn more at activelysafe.com.
So security software evolved to try to protect you from ever even getting infected by blocking the URL when you attempted to go to it, by detecting the file being downloaded and saying, no, this file has bad reputation, you're not going to be able to run it. So the tests needed to evolve to be able to address that. So I said one of the biggest issues that we have in testing is sample selection. And there's a number of different reasons for that. It used to be pretty simple. Back in, say, in the 80s and the 90s, it was black and white. You had viruses and you had clean files. We did have the beginnings of the problems with some viruses didn't work. They could not actually infect another file. So if you included those in a test, it was somewhat questionable because they weren't really viruses. You have a problem of diversity of families. I can have two sample sets, both containing a million files. One is made up of a million files of the same family that I've just replicated a million times, and the other one is made up of a whole different collection of families, maybe 500,000 families with two examples of each. If I test products with it, I'm going to get very different results on that. So the numbers, they're not really as important as how representative those numbers are of what's out there. Grayware. There are files that are bad for one customer. Some customers don't want ads on their machine. Other customers accept the ads because they get something for free. There are legitimate applications that can be retooled by malware authors to do nefarious things. So do you detect those or not? We call these potentially unwanted applications. There are legal challenges. Sometimes a security company will detect a file and say, we think this thing is bad, and that company will sue us and say, you can't call us bad. And after going around the league, we say, okay, we agree, we won't detect you. If those types of samples get included in a test, then it's It's very unfair because the big companies that were sued can't detect it, but some of the smaller companies that the company didn't bother suing because they're not really affecting their business, they can continue to detect these without problem. And then there are junk samples. They're just they're not really correctly formed executables. They won't run properly, but they still sometimes find their way into sample sets used within testing. So let's dig into diversity. There are many more samples out there than there are malware families. At any one time, there's probably less than 1,000 or so active malware families that are running. Yet we know that there are millions of new pieces of malware created every day. So how can that be? Well, server-side polymorphism is the biggest answer for that. There are certain family threats that when you go to this website and download a piece of malware, you get by MD5 or by SHA-2 a unique file. It was never seen before. It'll never be seen again. But it's the same file underneath it. It's just been obfuscated on top of that. Determining that you've got a diverse set is hindered by the point that was raised earlier, that many security companies are using generic names. Within Symantec, we call a lot of stuff just Trojan Gen. We don't care what it is. We know it's bad. We want it off our customers' boxes, but we don't know anything more than that. So it's hard for you to tell necessarily that you've got different sets of family. Did you get a whole bunch from a single family that we call Trojan Gen, or did you get samples from 20 families that we all call Trojan Gen? Server-side polymorphism, different physical files, same thread underneath. They're using packing and other obfuscation techniques. And then targeted attacks. These samples aren't widely distributed, so it's going to be very hard for a tester to lay hands on them. So it makes it difficult to be able to tell how well a given product is going to do against a targeted attack without having samples that are used in those targeted attacks. Grayware and PUAs. Some samples are hard to classify. They're adware. They're considered hack tools by some. In some cases, adware is a bad thing, depending on whether or not you really invited it onto your box. Fake AV was a big example of this. People thought they were installing security software, and what they did is they just opened up an avenue to have a whole bunch of ads. And there was actually a double problem there because they thought they had done a good thing, and actually what they'd done was a bad thing. The potentially unwanted apps, they're good apps that can be used for bad things. TFTP is used by a lot of bots and other malware to exfiltrate things off of the box. Should we detect and should we block anything that TFTP does? Well, there are legitimate uses for TFTP, and it would be interfering if we do that. Location and name matter in this case sometimes. TFTP running from the Windows system directory, that's one thing. TFTP called, foo.x running out of the temporary directory, that's probably a different thing. But you need to have an actual machine infected and running within that scenario for the software to be able to tell a difference. If you just take TFTP as a standalone file and include it in your sample set, your mileage is going to vary as to whether or not a security product detects it and whether or not they should or should not have detected it. Legal challenges. They say some software companies sue AV companies, but they don't sue every AV company. The bigger you are, the more likely you are to get sued if you call something bad. And if we have to remove our detection from it, and some smaller regional antivirus companies don't remove their detection for it, and then these samples find their way into tests, it biases the test against the bigger companies.
Is there a related issue of political pressure? I know how some governments use spyware stuff, and various AV companies will still flag it, and I can imagine that they'll get pressure if they don't flag our stuff, political or legal.
Yeah, there have been rumors of that for years.
Yeah.
Within my knowledge, it's not that big of an issue. No entity came to us and said, we'd really prefer you don't detect Stuxnet. But I don't know that it's never happened. And one of the other complications is the settlements to these lawsuits, they're not discussed. So there's really no way for the tester to know without contacting an AV company as to, you know, why aren't you detecting this? Junk. Some files don't have any executable code. They don't work. So they really shouldn't be included in tests. And then there's testers that will include HTML files. Now, HTML files can include malicious code, but detecting it with your command line scanner doesn't do anything to protect the customer because the code has already been rendered in the browser and executed. All they're seeing is a latent writing of that file to disk for caching purposes. So you could have a product that 100% detects malicious HTML on disk, and it will provide zero protection to its customers because, say, the infection's already happened in it. So the testers really need to understand how the malware works and how the operating system and the entire system works and how the security product is attempting to play within that scope.
Speaking of junk, the problem we run into often is the malware is just brittle. Darn stuff doesn't run unless everything's just right in its environment. And I would think that's a challenge here too.
Yes.
You know, how do you even know if the thing is junk or there's just something missing from the environment or what?
Yeah, it's definitely a problem. You can have a piece of, even if it functions. If the, take a bot, for example, whose command and control network is gone. So what you're going to see from a detection standpoint or from a behavioral standpoint, there's a piece of software, it arrived on my disk, it attempted to do some network traffic, it got no response, and then it did nothing else. Well, if we blocked everything that did that, we would have a huge false positive problem. So it's very important when doing these tests to determine that the malware that you're testing is actually alive and kicking. Yes, sir?
Classified Bluepill, Redpill, VMware malware, the same thing?
Yes. That's one of the, the question was, do we classify the problem of malware, which is VMware? Many malware authors, they figure that the back-end systems are running virtualized, very often VMware, so they'll say, if we detect that VMware is running, we won't do anything. So that way when the researcher gets our file and they try to execute it, we'll look fine. If testers are testing in a virtualized environment, then they're going to be hindering behavioral analysis systems because they're not performing that way. There was actually a paper presented at AVAR a couple of years ago where the recommendation was to make a real machine look like it's a virtual machine in order to prevent certain classes of malware from ever executing on it. So that's why when you're doing tests, it's really important to use bare metal systems for running the tests. Now, I would imagine within targeting attacks, I don't know this specifically, but that balance could be shifting where if you're trying to target a corporation and you suspect or you know that that corporation is running virtualized machines, then you wouldn't want to execute if you were not on a virtualized machine. So it's going to really depend on what the threat is and having specific knowledge about what you are testing.
With your some example file or some executables do not function, I've been seeing a bunch of times where recently what we're getting is pieces of the executable in pieces, in separate URL calls, and then some JavaScript or Java code combining them into the actual executable. Is that something that you're seeing in that, or is that?
That would be part of it. It underscores the importance of actually running the threat in a natural environment to be able to determine whether or not the security software stopped it. If you've changed the game, so you've taken those individual pieces and say that these things should be detected, not necessarily. If they're not exhibiting malicious activity, it's a little unfair to classify that. It's kind of an interesting swing that happened. For years, everyone said signatures are dead, they're bad, they can't keep up, they're reactive. So we switched to behavioral or more proactive technologies that run on the client, yet the testing methodology hasn't followed as quickly, and we get penalized. You could have a completely proactive, blocked every known threat out there. If it did it without signatures, it would look like a very bad product by most testing that's done today. So that's what things haven't caught up enough. Yes?
So my experience, it's been really important to use routing samples that's less than a week old because if I'm testing a bunch of products, some of which are more signature-based and others are more heuristic-based, and if the malware is more than a week old or so, then results tend to favor the more signature-based approaches. So for me, it's been really important to just get really, really fresh new stuff.
Yes. Well, yeah, freshness is really important for a number of reasons. One is the malware is more likely to actually work and be malware because they have a short shelf life on them. And the security companies, if they're on a trailing edge, will catch up to it. And even freezing definitions doesn't work anymore because many security companies now are using cloud-based technology to do their detection. So you could freeze the on-disk definitions, but that's not going to freeze the company's opinion or the security product's opinion of whether or not that file is clean or dirty. And then there's some overall challenges. Transparency. There's a number of tests that are run on products and you know very little about what they did. They say, we ran a bunch of samples and we evaluated performance and here's the results we have. I was like, well, how are we supposed to know what you did was correct? How do we know that the results are correct? What action can we take if the results are correct and our product didn't do well? It's very difficult. So it's very important for testers to release the methodology that they used when performing the test, release the hashes of the samples that they used within the test. Some testing organizations, they don't want to release the samples. That's fine. But you can at least give us the hashes so that we can go out and try to find the samples. And if you have hashes that we can't find, that's going to tell us a little something as well. And then having a proper contact. So somebody, when you publish a test, that there's someone there that we can call up and get answers to our technical questions. We understand that not everything that we care about as a security company is going to be important enough for you to put, particularly if it's a magazine or something like that, that they're going to publish in that. But there should be somebody that we can contact and get a deep dive as to what was done so that we can know, A, whether or not we can give you some suggestions about how you might improve the testing in the future or understand what happened on the test that we had. So to that end, the AMTSO came up with the 9 principles of good testing. So the first, testing must not endanger the public. Now that brings up an interesting point now where we're talking about doing live internet testing of samples. So how do you do that and not endanger the public? One of the things that aided us in doing that is the threats around the mid-2000s switched from being just spreading for fun and profit, worms that just spread for the sake of spreading, which could really harm the public, to being actually more targeted to the machine itself. Most threats don't actively spread amongst other machines. So there are worms and things that are still out there, but mostly it's done now by you being driven to a website and getting your machine infected. It doesn't go and infect your neighbor's machine. So you're not really, by getting your machine infected, if it's a test machine, you're not endangering the public, you're just endangering yourself. Other things that can be done is to make sure that you're doing these tests on slow internet connections. A lot of the testing companies, they'll just use an ISDN line, something that's fairly slow, so that even if something starts to spread, they're only running the sample for a little bit of time, they're limiting the damage. But if you divorce the security testing now from the internet, you're going to get very different results because most of us, A, don't run in a disconnected state, and B, we don't get infected in a disconnected state.
We have exactly this problem also, containment. How do we, what sort of interaction do we allow? And have generally framed it like you, which is, well, prudence says, in fact, today, there's not going to be much, and do some rate limiting, et cetera. And it's not airtight, and I don't think it can be. I'm wondering if you actually, have a best practices document or something in this space, because that would be handy for us to be able to point to.
I believe that some of the documents we have, and I'll reference them on upcoming slide, do talk about these issues. And the main thing that we're conveying with this point is you need to at least think about what the effect of what you're testing is going to be. You don't just blindly go out and get a bunch of samples and start running them on a box on a live internet, not having any, having given any thought to what might happen if you do that. Certainly, if you start doing that within your company, you're gonna have some troubles. Testing must be unbiased. A tester should not really enter a test with an agenda of, I'm going to prove AV companies are bad, or I'm going to do this, because that's going to affect the way that they put their test together. Testing should be reasonably open and transparent, meaning you should be able to tell us what you did and why you did it and how you did it. The effectiveness and performance must be measured in a balanced way. So if you're going to do a performance test of a security product on a heavily infected machine, that is going to give you a very different result than if you perform that performance test on a clean machine. And most users' machines are not heavily infected, and if they are heavily infected, they're willing to spend the extra time to get the machine cleaned up. So it's not a fair comparison. The tester should take reasonable care to validate whether or not the samples of the tests have accurately been classified as malicious or benign. One of the advantages that a tester has is time. They can gather their samples and test whether or not a product detected it or not. And at a later date, 2-3 weeks later, they can then go back and find out whether or not that sample was malicious or clean, and then go back and classify whether or not the detection then was proper, or was the miss proper. This is something which is not being done, and I think a lot of testers are spending time trying to pre-classify samples, and as was mentioned earlier, time is really of the essence, because the longer you wait on that sample, the less accurate, in some senses, your result of it might be. So if you get the sample and test it very quickly, you can go back later and do a validation as to whether or not it was clean or dirty. The testing methodology must be consistent with the testing purpose. So the example that we always talked about with an AMSO was what we called the chair test, which is we are going to test which is the best security product. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to duct tape the DVD of that product onto a chair and throw it off a 10-story building. And the DVD that suffers the least damage is the best product. Well, it is. You know, I've just described my methodology, so I've satisfied that kind of the principle. Now, I've conducted the test in a reasonable way, and I've got a consistent way of managing the damage to it. But my methodology has nothing to do with testing the effectiveness of it. And where this becomes really important is you have tests which test the online or test the static file scanning capability of a product. That's fine if you're saying we're comparing the static capabilities of these products. But when you then extrapolate those results and say, and this product is better, now you've got to disconnect, because you didn't test the product. You tested one aspect of the product. So it's really important that you get the right mix of things that you're doing and make your conclusions match what you actually tested. Which leads to the next one. The conclusions of a test must be based on the actual test results. You can't run a bunch of tests and say, yeah, but this one did better. Test results should be statistically valid. You should have tested enough samples. I can't go download 5 samples and say, okay, product A is better than product B, as you don't really know that. And having an active contact point. So questions you should ask yourself when you're evaluating test results. How many samples were used? How were those samples obtained? How were they validated? What was the variety of the samples? How were they tested? How were the detections and misses verified? And was false positive testing performed? About 25 years ago, Dr. Solomon came up with the perfect antivirus solution that would detect all viruses, past, present, and future, with zero false positives. You say, why isn't this product on the market? Well, the first part was a batch file that said, echo %1 is a virus. That will now determine, that will detect every virus or a piece of malware, past, present, and future. Has a slight problem with false positives. So there's a second batch file that said echo %1 is not a virus. So that has zero false positives. And then to stitch it all together, he created a third batch file that says, is %1 a virus? If yes, run batch file A. If no, run batch file B. There's your perfect antivirus solution. There's still a number of tests being conducted today where they don't take into consideration false positives. And I can tell you from a security company standpoint, we spend more time trying to fix and limit our false positives than we do detecting malware. Detecting bad things is actually relatively easy. Problem is, there's a number of good things that look like that as well. And some customers will turn you off if they get infected, but more customers will turn you off if you annoy the hell out of them. And this has been a real hindrance to getting certain security technologies turned on within corporations. They're very scared of the FPA. They don't want that phone to ring. They don't want to get infected, but they don't want the phone to ring either. So if you don't perform false positive testings, there are some products out there that have a really good detection rate, but in practice, they're unusable. So what are our conclusions here? Testing is a hard problem. And more research into proper testing, I think, is warranted. We've talked about the technical challenges. There are some ethical challenges that need to be looked at in your testing. And I think it's clear there's more research that's needed. There's only a handful of legitimate shops out there that are doing testing. To that end, my colleague Jose here, also on the board of directors of AMTSO, is hosting the workshop on anti-malware testing and research, WATER. It will be held in Montreal on October 30th, 2013. And you can go to this website to find out more information, and better yet, quickly submit a paper. Here are some resources that you can find. AMSO.org is our main website. We have a number of papers that are covering all the best practices. They are behind a form wall. You don't have to. You will be asked to enter an email address. You can say no@spam.com, and that's fine. I think you can even leave it blank, and that's fine. But at least we have to ask you. And then the documents are free to download. So, any additional questions? Yes?
So I noticed on your website the most recent guidelines are about a year and a half old. Are you still actively adding these sometimes?
Yes, there's one that the document that's in progress, and we're behind on it, and we're annoyed that we're behind on it, is for testing mobile malware. The other document, there hasn't been much change in the arena of things that need to be doing for testing PC software, so we think our best practices there are pretty up to date. But mobile malware brings in a lot of issues, and that one's being evaluated. I'll also tell you, there's one problem that we found based on our examples or our attempts at it to be essentially intractable. And I wouldn't have believed it until we actually dug into it, and that is web FPs. And testing FPs on a website. Since everything is dynamic about it, there is really no way to know if a block on a given website at a given point in time was correct or not. The tester can't know, the security companies can't know, and everything we did to try to come up with guidelines on how you can properly do that, it fell apart. So, yes?
So one thing to add to your nine principles is ensure that companies are comparing apples to apples. I mean, one of the most frustrating things in the antivirus selection game is that different companies advertise different features. And you're not sure what you're getting. Is this a heuristic behavior detection? Is this a heuristic only focused on device detection? You know, what is it going on? It's absolutely frustrating. I've been tasked to select an antivirus product for a large enterprise, and I'll tell you, just going by the literature chain on the websites, it's clueless.
Yes, and there's another complication that gets added to that is that many times a security company's marketing department is not in sync with their technical department. And they will make claims about what this software does and how it should be used. We've had cases where we wanted to run a specific test, and we wanted to select a given company's product to be tested against us. And we were told, no, that's not an apples-to-apples comparison. This is not a server security product. Well, if I go to their website and I look at their marketing material, they say, this is for server security. So, yeah, it's a problem.
So we should stop here right for lunch. See you back at 2 o'clock. Let's thank the speaker.